This is WABF, and it's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campominosi of the Common Sense Campaign, an adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and in Malbus on 181 with a state-of-the-art car wash. And good morning, Dr. Lou.
Once again, good morning to you, Laurie. Nice Monday morning out here, and we need rain, I know that, but I'd just as soon have a little bit of sunshine.
I wish I had the Ed Sullivan soundbite of it's going to be a really good show, because you have got a major topic that all of us need to be listening to and paying attention to today.
Well, yes, we do have a good show, I think, today. We've got an excellent individual coming in. I've had him on the show before, Lieutenant Commander D. Cox. He is a retired Naval Intelligence Officer, 8 combat tours with the SEALs. He is a China expert, speaks the language, and knows intimately what is going on in China, okay? And so I've asked Deke to come on the show and take us through a broad range within 30 minutes, okay? Unless you are going to give us a few extra minutes, which I know you always do. But we want to hear from Deke what he says about China's grand strategy, about American vulnerabilities, about the Taiwan question, and just kind of lay the groundwork for a serious discussion about what we need to be doing to combat China's dangerous approach to international relations and to the relations with the United States. So that's what we're going to do. Before Deke calls in, he's going to call in a few minutes. I want to be able to go back to last week's discussion with Secretary Merrill and talk just a little bit about my real concerns about what's going on in Georgia. Okay, you know that we talked about the discussion that Secretary Merrill had with various secretaries of state at their meeting on July 9th in Baton Rouge. Those kinds of meetings, I think, are important. But unless those secretaries of state are focusing on election integrity, and especially from the Republican ones that had major trouble in the battleground states, then it seems to me that we're just kind of whistling in the dark here. And my major concern that came out about after our discussion with Secretary Merrill was what was going on in Georgia with the Secretary of State there by the name of Raffensperger. I've said this to you all before, and I'll say it once again. Raffensperger and Governor Kemp were part of the problem in Georgia in 2020. As it stands right now, Raffensperger is attempting to undermine the argument that is being made by Greg Phillips and Catherine Engelbrecht of True the Vote that the mules that were hired by these various non-for-profit groups funded by Soros and Zuckerberg and others, those mules were designed to do one thing: stuff ballots in Georgia and other places, but in Georgia especially, okay? And the fact that Greg Phillips and Engelbrecht were able to find video showing this one particular individual who is in a red car, it's a black guy, stuffing ballots, they fell out of his first attempt, and then he finally gets them in. Raffensperger claimed to Secretary of State Merrill, because I asked Merrill to ask Raffensperger this, what do you think about this? And his basic argument was that they had found this individual, and they had tracked him down. They found him because of the license plate number, and they basically claimed that this guy was legitimate. Now, understand this. The fact is, the whole argument that Greg Phillips and Engelbrecht are making is that these mules went from place to place to place. And yet Raffensperger is claiming that this guy was legitimate. So the real question is, can we find, and will it be demonstrated, which I think it will be, that this guy actually did go from place to place to place? That's the issue that has to be taken care of right now. The second issue that needs to be understood here, okay, and this is why I've said that Raffensperger is especially part of the problem. Not only did Raffensperger keep drop boxes, okay? I mean, that the big no-no, okay? Everyone knows that. And even the Wisconsin Supreme Court recently came out, and I think I mentioned this to you all, that the way they did drop boxes in Wisconsin last time was illegal, okay? So that we all know that this is a problem. So why does Raffensperger keep drop boxes? Kind of an interesting question. But here's an even worse part of this question. Why did he take away the video cameras as part of the security apparatus that was there before? Kind of a no-brainer. I mean, he doesn't want security. He's inviting the very same problems that existed last time. So, amen to that, okay? It's now 10:10, and I had asked Commander Cox to come on the show at 10:10, and so Laurie tells me he's on the line. Good morning there, Deke. How are you doing?
Hey, good morning, Dr. Lou. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, frustrated as ever with Alabama politics and all the rest of it. But I am glad to have you on this morning. Good to hear you. You're calling in from Texas, is that right?
Yes, sir. Working here in South Texas.
All right. So let's get right to the heart of this, okay? I sent you a note, and we agreed that we're going to talk about, you know, several different things this morning. So the first topic was, I think, this whole question of China's grand strategy versus the United States. So can you paint this picture for us, and then we'll just cover some of the other agenda items as we get into it, okay?
Sure. So China's grand strategy dates back to really the 1970s and post-Mao, Deng Xiaoping, and they realized that if they were ever going to compete with America, and really the goal was set to surpass America as the lone superpower in the world, that they had to have a strategy for that. And so Deng Xiaoping, you know, led China into an era of build capability but hide your talents. And so, you know, as they came through the 1980s, 90s, especially post Tiananmen Square, they entered the period of engagement. And this was even in light of the, you know, the Bush administration's, this was George H.W. Bush, right? Or George, yeah. And so he basically decided that post Tiananmen they were going to engage with China and basically do anything that it took to facilitate China's increased standing in the world. And it was straight up driven by two things. One was the business community and a desire for profits and locating cheap labor. And then also this misplaced worldview that if we engage China enough, that China would change. And, you know, and change for the better. And so that hasn't really happened. So, you know, that realization, I would say, you know, certain people within the intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, realized this by probably 2000, 2005. And this, you know, we were well informed by scholarly writings and writings out of the People's Liberation Army of China, where they, you know, they showed no moderation of their Marxist values and indeed were stepping up their philosophy and strategy of subverting the United States and really engaging us in a version of Cold War. And you know, we didn't even try to recognize that and combat it until, you know, the 2016 time frame. So, you know, I've spoken about Kerry Gershanik's book, Political Warfare, and China's Plan to Win Without Fighting. And I would again recommend that to your listeners and recognize that, you know, Colonel Gershanik, you know, has had deep experience in Soviet Cold War strategies combating the United States, but China has adapted their policies, their strategies, and kind of folded it into this comprehensive national power. And they're very good. I would say that they're probably 10 times more effective than the Soviet Union ever was. Right. And that's where we find ourselves today in 2022. This comes to a head in COVID because, you know, there's a whole lot to discuss there. But basically, you know, the virus came out of Wuhan, but it was a direct product of China's engagement policy with the United States. You know, the United States Army laboratories hired multiple Chinese scientists over the years to, you know, into some of our most sensitive programs, and, you know, and that's well documented. And so when you look at where the virus came from, it was an engineered virus. The Chinese were certainly in on that. We've had revelations in the last year or two that Dr. Fauci and the NIH, you know, were directly funding the labs in Wuhan. But, you know, we've got this other aspect of this cancerous corruption that comes from dealing with the Chinese, which is that you now have this, you know, kind of unholy alliance of big pharma, driven largely by greed, but also by their corruption and basically regulatory capture of the USDA and the US CDC, you know, with the Chinese and the Chinese influence. And they are running amok in the world right now with pushing vaccines, and you know, there's certainly a lot to talk about as far as their strategy and their reasons for doing so.
Right. Let me ask you this real quick. In terms of the evolution of our response to this, my understanding is that the Clinton people were just absolutely determined to expand the relationship. Clinton got them into the World Trade Organization. They never enforced the WTO's trade approaches to fair trade and things like that. But in the end, I've seen documents that were sent to the Clinton people and just completely ignored about some of the things that you've mentioned earlier about China's, you know, ability to manipulate things in the United States and become a real threat. So, I mean, from an institutional standpoint, the FBI and the counterintelligence people like that, I mean, is it your sense that they have kind of fallen into a lackadaisical approach to this? Or I know with Trump they started to do more things with it, but that 20-year interval between Clinton and Trump seems to have sort of set the stage for an absolutely inefficient, that might be a nice way to put it, if not a complete corruption of the system. I mean, what is your sense of that?
Yeah, so we can go back to the Clinton administration and the Maria Shah political contribution corruption scandal, where the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, was secreting money into the Clinton campaign, right, and the Democratic National Convention. This was a huge scandal in the 1996-97 time frame, and it just seems like most Americans and certainly our law enforcement organizations, you know, just don't even have memory of it. It's stunning when you really look at it. And one of the other ways that China has subverted and continues to subvert the United States and the United States government, our business community, is of course, by they recognized early on that pure greed accomplishes an awful lot. And so the promise of big profits in China, you know, lured the likes of Dianne Feinstein and her husband, you know, the Democratic senator from California.
Right.
You know, on the Republican side, you know,
McConnell and her
Mitch McCollum and Elaine
wife,
Chao,
yeah.
You know, his wife, and she's, her family is mainland Chinese, even though they have Taiwanese roots post Civil War, the Chinese Civil War. It just, it's one of these things where the Chinese have continued to subvert and buy out the U.S. political class, and what that has done is that, because all the agencies, of course, work for the different political leadership, it's had this persistent, corrosive environment where you now have it manifesting in the FBI and the CIA and our other intelligence agencies, where political appointees tended to drift further towards the left and socialist ideologies, and even, you know, as we're talking about post-Trump, where they have actively attempted to purge conservative leadership or conservative thought from law enforcement and the national intelligence community here in the U.S. So, you know, it's a big part of the problem. And when you look at political contributions and the role of the United Front Work Department, UFWD, and Professor Gershanik talks about this in his book, but the influence of the Chinese Consultative Congress, People's Congress, which is the CCCP, and the UFWD works for them, they've pumped billions of dollars into overseas subversion efforts, some of them overt, like the purchase of Phoenix Radio in Southern California and their broadcasting center across the international line in Tijuana, and their ability to broadcast CCP propaganda across Phoenix radio station network in Southern Cal is a prime example of how their overt influence operates. But then you look at things like CUSEF, which is the China-U.S. Foundation out of New York City, and their continual, you know, cancerous push with funded by Chinese money, you know, the Chinese influence within the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, and so on the business interest side of things. And so it has been a constant form of Chinese water torture, is how I describe it, where it's constant pressure exerted over time to meet China's goals within their comprehensive power, and it's working. You know, when you look at 2020 and you look at the money that came in, now there was an awful lot of money with Zuckerbucks, you know, from Mark,
yeah,
Zuckerberg,
right,
$429 million that came in that had a immediate corrosive influence on elections and the way local electors ran elections in every district in the United States. But when you look at China's funding through NGOs, money provided by the United Front Work Department, you know, you're looking at Chinese money finding its way to Black Lives Matter and to any number of other leftist organizations in the United States that continually, you know, agitate against the establishment and against liberty and freedom and democracy. And it's not just the United States either, Dr. Liu. I mean, we're focused here on the U.S., but, you know, our allies in Australia, they, you know, they're a large country geographically, but there's only, you know, 26, 27 million Australians. And, you know, a little bit of Chinese foreign influence money goes a long way, much further in Australia than it does in the United States. And Australia is actually in worse position than we are here in the U.S. You know, but that influence is worldwide. We see it in the EU. We see it in Africa. You know, it's not just that the Chinese have their eyes set on us, although we are their ultimate goal of supplanting us as the world's lone superpower.
Well, Deke, let me just ask you this. It seems to me that as one of the elements of China's grand strategy, creating these fifth columns, as I've described it, is part of it. But the other part of it is this Belt and Road program. Can you explain how they use the Belt and Road, strategy to enhance their control over some of these countries, particularly third world countries that need, developments of ports and things like that?
Sure. So one of the other key pillars of China's corruption to the business community has been their use of foreign investment and the way that they turn that around within the banking community. And their primary tool with the Belt and Road Initiative, and again, this has been around, it was announced shortly after Xi Jinping took power in 2012, so even though it's only 10 years old, they had simultaneously stood up the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, and then of course that has Chinese principals. And what they do with that is that they walk in and they offer lucrative loans to places like Sri Lanka. And of course Sri Lanka has been in the news recently because they're bankrupt.
Right.
And of course the media doesn't want to talk about why they're bankrupt, and there's a lot of anger out there about Rajapaksa and some of the people in power in Sri Lanka, which were placed in power, guaranteed to be in power, when they signed on with the Chinese towards the end of the Sri Lankan civil war back in 2007-2008. And so all of this goes back to Chinese influence in Sri Lanka and the Belt and Road Initiative and Sri Lanka's acceptance of some really bad loans that allowed them to build basically an airport in the middle of nowhere that was political patronage. Nobody uses the airport. It doesn't benefit the people of Sri Lanka, but yet the people of Sri Lanka are heavily in debt to the Chinese to pay back the loan for that airport, and not just the airport, but then the Hamdan Toda port facilities in Colombo. And it's just a bill that they can't pay. And any reasonable banker would have, taken one look at the loan as promulgated by the Chinese back in 2009 and 10 and 11, and immediately walked away from that as a bad deal for their nation. But it's a classic example of how China uses foreign investment and then turns around and uses those billions and billions, hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars to put that into really corrupt and unethical banking practices in nations that are really prostrate to them and really at mercy, especially once they get their hooks into them with these very harsh terms. And what happens is that the Chinese will play hardball, and when the country can't pay, and the Chinese know that they won't be able to pay, they then default on the loan. The Chinese refuse to refinance it, and the IMF, which is also under political sway from the CCP, will refuse to augment the loan or refinance the debt, and so it falls right back into the Chinese port, which is that they can then take possession of the port and then use it in their string of pearls strategy, which was promulgated back about 15, 16 years ago, and it's the Chinese goal strategy to place ports and facilities at places like Sri Lanka and throughout the Indian Ocean. They've made efforts in the Maldives. They've agitated against the U.S. presence at Diego Garcia with the British, and basically just using their caustic influence to try and change the status quo in the Indian Ocean, which allows them to threaten their number one immediate problem, which is India. And so, it's a whole separate discussion that we can have about the China-India relationship, but it is, we have to understand that today's crises in Sri Lanka were set in place and set in motion when the seeds were planted with bad banking deals, you know, as long as 15 years ago.
Well, let me ask you this, in terms of the string of pearls, I mean, doesn't it seems likely that they're doing the same thing in the South China Sea, declaring it a lake and militarizing islands and then creating islands. Is that basically your assessment of that?
It is. So the Chinese use a strategy in the South China Sea with their military / militia operations, and they call that strategy, we've named it, and we coined it from a Chinese proverb about salami slicing. And so what they basically do is they come in and they just nibble. They'll take an island that, you know, might not have, or it might have just been a reef, and a key example would be the Fiery Cross Reef or Subi, Mischief Reef. And these are ostensibly in other nations' exclusive economic zones, and what China has done over the last 30 years, really, you can track it all the way back to an effort against the Vietnamese in the 1980s and then again in the 1990s, where, you know, they'll just move in under the cover of dark, and then it's de facto ownership because the Chinese have bothered to put boots on the ground, and possession is 9/10 of the law in the South China Sea. And at the same time, they conduct political lawfare where they create this fake history of Chinese ownership of the South China Sea, and then they manufacture this false narrative that they continually play on the national, international scene, which is that this is Chinese territory since ancient times, and they produce, you know, evidence and artifacts supposedly from ancient times supporting their position. And it's been debunked by so many scholars, Lou, over the years, that, you know, everybody recognized the strategy, but because China's corruption is so widespread, nobody will stand up and call them out on it, and then certainly with any consequence.
Right.
The sole exception was
Trump.
When the Hague issued a decision back in 2015,
right,
which basically held up the Philippines' ownership of their exclusive economic zone, and under international law as it currently exists, they recognize that the Chinese are basically squatting on Chinese territory.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, given what you just said about the South China Sea, let's talk about this element of their military approach to the United States, because it seems to me what they're trying to do is to expand their power base from the mainland into the South China Sea and elsewhere. Okay, you've already talked about it in the Indian Ocean, but is the major threat to the Chinese coming from our 7th Fleet, the Pacific Fleet? And if so, what are they doing to neutralize our ability to project power into that region?
Sure. So the Chinese have a strategy. They recognize that, one, that nobody really likes them, even though they try and say that they have all of these relationships with people. They've moved on from addressing the first island chain to subverting the second island chain and other tiny Pacific nations like, you know, Fiji and Tonga and any number, you know, all of the Pacific islands.
Right.
You've gone in with that same broken model of loans. They build port facilities in places like Tonga, and they give these tiny nation states out there, you know, these huge bills that they'll never be able to repay. And again, you know, whether it comes in 5 years or 10 years, the Chinese strategy has worked. And so what the U.S. government just announced today was that they are re-engaging and stepping up their engagement, placing consulates and embassies in a couple of these island nations, these Pacific states, to shore up our relationship that has really languished since the end of World War II. And in an effort to counter Chinese influence in around the Second Island Chain and into the South Pacific. This is also to reassure our allies in Australia and New Zealand that, you know, that we are engaged in the region and that we are pushing back on the Communist Chinese. But, you know, if you even back out the aperture on that a little bit, you know, go back and look at the First Island Chain and what, you know, the CCP has done with funneling in money into the Japanese Communist Party, the JCP, in Okinawa and in other parts of Japan, where, you know, you'll get these protests outside U.S. bases in Okinawa, and it's not sponsored by, you know, the Japanese government, which there's a history of that over the years. You know, when the Japanese government would be approaching new negotiations with the U.S., they would use the strategy of ramping up protests around the U.S. bases to, right, you know, to kind of, you know, shape the negotiations a little bit. But about 20 years ago, we began to see a shift where the people that were showing up outside the gates were not recognized by the Japanese as part of their own agitators, right? And right. And I want to be clear, we maintain a very good and strong relationship with the Japanese government, and that improved significantly under the leadership of Shinzo Abe. You know, God rest his soul, right. He was assassinated a couple of weeks ago, and you know, we can talk about, was there a CCP angle to that? There may have been, but you know, when we look at what China is doing, they continually try and undercut and subvert the health and vigor in our allied relationships. They recognize that if they can sunder and cause a divorce in any number of these relationships, especially the U.S.-Japan relationship, the Five Eyes relationship, you know, where right. It made serious inroads with New Zealand and the administration of Jacinda Ardern, you know, then they're winning. And if they can maintain that kind of pressure and success over many years and decades, then they will, in effect, drive America from the West Pacific.
Well, let me ask you this from the military standpoint. I know that they have been undertaking massive buildups of their own Navy, but they've also built, you know, an anti-ship missile capability that's land-based, if I'm not mistaken. Just talk to us about that threat and the degree to which the Pacific Fleet can defend itself against that, and it'll lead us right into a question about how we're going to defend Taiwan. Can you talk about that for just a second? Because we're getting close to the end here.
Sure. So, yeah, absolutely. So China has developed a family of missiles over the last three decades, and what a lot of Western analysts miss, and they don't give enough credit for, Dr. Liu, are the People Liberation Army, Air Force, rocket forces.
Mm-hmm.
And they are robust. The West doesn't have anything like it. And, you know, the only thing that we have like it here in the United States is U.S. STRATCOM. And, you know, maybe some deployed capability within the Army, like their Patriot missiles and HIMARS and such
right.
like that. But it's... The real challenge is that the Chinese have developed a robust capability to strike U.S. carrier task forces as they deploy out of Yokosuka and Guam and Pearl Harbor and San Diego, and even if they had to, they could go and strike you know, allies such as Singapore. And so they do this with the DF-31 and 41 family of missiles. They're converted intercontinental ballistic missiles with multiple reentry vehicles, and we've got direct evidence that the Chinese have been practicing against mock-ups of U.S. port facilities, Japanese port facilities, and also, you know, U.S. carriers. And so when we look at their approach versus our ability to shape and influence their standoff weapons, which is what the DF-31 and 41 would be used for, they are further down the road than we are. And the real challenge with that is that if they punch first and knock out some of our capital assets, we never even get beyond the second island chain to approach the first island chain, or in the terms of the U.S. 7th Fleet out of Yokosuka, they might not even be able to get underway.
Can the Aegis we're running out of time, but can the Aegis system that's on our ships counter the Chinese missile threat?
Yeah, so what's in the open source press, Dr. Liu, is the SM-3, 4, 5, and 6 family of missiles have been improved stepwise to address some of those threats. Of course, I can't talk about that in much more detail.
Right.
But, you know, there is a response and defense capability, but the real question is it going to be enough? And the time that I have left, I just want to also emphasize that what the U.S. is really lacking, besides a horrible policy of selecting the wrong naval platforms over the last 20 and 30 years to build and refurbish and overhaul to maintain service, such as the Aegis cruisers, you know, they've been allowed to atrophy, and yet we've sunk billions and billions of dollars into the littoral combat ship, which is absolutely no use, you know, to us in a fight with China. The other area that we're falling behind on is anti-ship cruise missiles, and you know, the only thing that we have to offer is the very old Harpoon missile system. And you know, and if you're going to counter Chinese Navy assets, which between they and their militia, they're going to outnumber us anywhere from 4 to 5 to 1.
Right.
And they're going to have many more missiles in the box than we're going to be able to counter with, and that's a real problem.
Well, Deke, you know, that's a somber note to end on, but I think that somberness, you know, is part of this equation if we're going to get anyone's attention to look at it. And I think that perhaps Jerry Carl and those folks down here who are always extolling the virtues of what they're spending money on at Austell, you know, they need to perhaps wake up to the facts that you're pointing out. And maybe when you get back here for your next time off, we'll try to have a meeting with Carl and see if we can't, you know, shed some light on this. But Deke, I have to say, I really appreciate your time and your efforts to come on, and I'm looking forward to seeing you when you get back in town, okay?
Yep, thank you, Dr. Liu. We need to talk about military recruiting as well.
Amen. Okay, we'll save that for another show. But you take care of yourself out in Texas. Stay cool out there. A little bit hot out in Texas.
All right.
All right, guy. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, Doc.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, Lori, I mean, when you start thinking about, you know, dealing with lots of missiles and few ships that can defend against it. I mean, the best thing to look at in terms of the Iron Dome with all those missiles coming in that the Israelis shoot these people down, that's what we need. And I know that there are some aspects of that can be employed. But, you know, too little too late at this point. So, folks, on that rather, you know, somber note, It's important for us to stay engaged in this. And it's I mean, you know how difficult it is for us to stay engaged on these issues. I mean, we've been swamped with the political campaign and all the rest of it. But I do think that we need to kind of start looking at this seriously. Here's another thing to look at seriously. This Wednesday, 10 o'clock, at the Fairhope Courthouse here on Fairhope Avenue, the Eastern Shore MPO is having another meeting, which they're going to talk about putting the bridge on the Transportation Improvement Plan, the TIP. So if you're free, and common sense people will be there, we'll take note of what's going on and make our voices heard about what we think are the good and the bad of the plans that they're talking about doing.
Thank you, Dr. Liu.
Until then, I will see you. Lowry, thank you for letting me stay on a little extra time.
You're welcome. Appreciate it.
Bye now. Bye.
You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Liu, brought to you by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne on Highway 98 and in Malbus on 181 with the state-of-the-art car wash. If you missed part of this program or you want to tell a friend, you'll be able to listen to it later at WABF1480.com.